You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, September 10th, 2020. I'm Matt Leck on another Matt, Brendan, Jamie, and Matt Binder Thursday. Broadcasting closer to the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal than ever before in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, in the throwback Michael interview with Liz Franzek, now known as one of the hosts of the True Anon podcast. This was in March 2019 to discuss her essay in The Baffler, The Century of Spin, and the origins of neoliberal sociopolitical culture. The story of Edward Bernays, who pioneered the field of modern public relations after serving under Woodrow Wilson during World War I, overseeing propaganda initiatives aimed at selling the war to the public and maximizing recruiting efforts. Also on the program, a DHS whistleblower says he was ordered to modify a threat assessment, particularly a section on white supremacy, to make the threat appear less severe and include information on the prominence of left-wing groups. The senior official, and I apologize, this is his full title, the senior official performing the duties of the United States Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security, Ken Cuccinelli, said in response, "Not seen to see here." It's not actually what he said, at least not yet. Another 884,000 Americans filed for unemployment for the first time last week, while 13.4 million American workers filed claims for unemployment insurance 2 weeks in a row. Also, Trump acknowledges he intentionally downplayed deadly coronavirus, says it was to reduce panic, and that he's America's cheerleader. Also, a new poll shows the public is deeply skeptical about any coronavirus vaccine approved before the November election. And then finally, this week in Always the People You Least Expect, Amazon.com Inc. charged inflated prices for hand sanitizer, disposable gloves, and other essentials after the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, a consumer watchdog said in a report accusing the world's largest online retailer of price cutting. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Hey, Brendan, how's it going?
Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. I can't help but think that maybe the America's cheerleader is the best way to approach the office of the presidency.
No, I think that's not how I would do it. And you know, what do I know?
Yeah, I think Biden should come out, you know, dressed as a quarterback and be like, I mean, that, you know, look.
Yeah, he's the quarterback, or he could be like the cool guy with the leather jacket and pull out that quarterback.
Oh, that's true also. Yeah. No, that's Bernie Sanders. Nah. Bernie's in the, you know, the parking lot with his leather jacket. Be like, football's for losers. We got to talk about class struggle. So, yeah, we're going to get right to the Michael interview today. I think people will recognize his guest. This is Liz Franzek. I'm not sure how much she did prior to this article, but she's a great writer. This article, The Century of Spin and Baffler, is great on Bernays. Bernays, who, after last week's episode, one of his relatives, descendants, was tweeting at me, and I wish I could find the tweet, but he said, hey, you should look into, you know, my ancestor Bernays, who started all this lie. And in fact, Michael actually did do that with Liz Franzek here for this this interview. So join themajorityreport.com. Keep us sustainable. We are not corporate news. And okay, I'm seeing my computer connection is a little bit weak. So we're going to try to play this from my computer right now.
I can roll it, actually. I have it.
You want to roll it? Okay, yeah. Cool. All right. So Brendan's going to roll this, and we will see you, Brendan and Jamie, after this.
To the Majority Report, Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Liz Franzek. She's a writer, and her recent piece in The Baffler, The Century of Spin, The Formative Days of Public Relations, Elites Imagined a quote-unquote guided democracy. Liz, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Oh,
Liz, my bad. Thanks so much for being here. You're here now.
Thank you so much.
So, Liz, can you start by talking about the tale of Atal Gawande and his recent joining of Amazon, but his role as a public intellectual and the sort of branding of conscience or branding of credibility as a way to kind of open up this conversation?
Yeah, so it was very interesting. I when I was doing some research for this piece, I came across PR story about Atul Gawande, who I had known. He's published several New York Times bestselling books. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's a doctor and a professor at Harvard Medical School, where, you know, he's been on Oprah. I mean, he's very, very, you know, very popular, as well as a pretty vigorous defender of the Affordable Care Act. And I saw that he had been recently appointed to a new position, I believe it's CEO, at Amazon's very secretive and I believe still unnamed healthcare venture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unclear exactly what Amazon is interested in, but the healthcare marketplace is a huge marketplace, as you could imagine. Not just within the insurance market, but also medical devices, hospitals, administration. I mean, the list goes on. It's a massive part of our economy. And so Bezos had recently joined with not just JP Morgan Chase, but also Berkshire Hathaway in this joint venture. And so I found it very interesting that they would appoint not just a Harvard professor, a CEO, of which, it's a bit of an interesting sort of lateral horizontal move, right?
Right.
But also someone who had such a, highly respected and intellectual and quite liberal reputation within the sort of, intellectual discourse, particularly around the role of the government in healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. Regarding debates around the ACA. It's a sort of an interesting move. And, I write in the piece that you kind of call this usually like a public relations coup, right? Because mm-hmm. it's such a hire. But I think it tells us a lot about the ways in which these, new monopolistic and rising monopolistic companies like Amazon sort of position themselves not just as companies that sell goods, but as companies that actually have a rightful place within our democracy.
And then you link this to a great document. I really enjoyed this. Adam Curtis's documentary on the century of the self. And when you point out, I like how you say every social media frenemy, Kanye West, tweeted out, and this is the tweet. This is one of his tweets that's more like his old producing and the fact that it's good, unlike some of his other tweets, which are more like his new records, but that's another conversation. It's 4 hours long, but you'll get the gist in the first 20 minutes, he wrote. Basically, Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, capitalized off of his uncle's philosophies and created modern-day consumerism. I think that actually is a pretty good description of at least some of the story Adam Curtis is telling in Century of the Self. First of all, I mean, who was Edward Bernays, and like, is that actually true? Is the story a lot more complicated than that?
I do think it's true, yes.
Yeah.
I think that, yes, I love that documentary. I love all of Adam Curtis's films. Highly recommend all his films.
Definitely.
Just a great film essayist. But I do think it's funny that, Kanye in that tweet, which you do point out, I think it is a good tweet, that he focuses on modern-day consumerism. And that was something I kind of wanted to pinpoint. And I do think that the popular narrative around Edward Bernays, who I'll get to in a second, is that, what he was sort of pioneering was a way to sell commercial goods, famously certain tobacco products and Coca-Cola, and that it kind of, spurned this kind of madman style advertising bonanza that shaped a lot of the 20th century. And I think that's true, but I don't think that it's the whole story. And that's kind of what I wanted to do, is sort of shade it a little bit. So, you know, Kanye and Adam Curtis, and also, of course, Noam Chomsky and Stuart Ewan, are completely correct in their positioning of Edward Bernays. He was Freud's nephew, famously, and wanted to sort of, in his mind, you know, popularize Freud for the American, you know, in the American popular imagination. But when I was sort of looking into him and looking into sort of what was percolating at the time that Bernays was writing his, you know, treatises on public relations, what I found is that, you know, public relations itself and what Bernays was advocating was really emanating out of what would come to be a much larger ideological project. And, you know, neoliberalism has become such a, like, catch-all phrase for so many things.
Right.
And a lot of people like to dismiss it as, you know, that either it's not a thing or it's like a slur, which I think is funny, or, you know, all these sorts of, like, hand-waving away. But it was, at the time that Bernays was writing, you know, and there were others as well that were looking at, basically in the interwar years, what they saw as emerging threats to liberal democracy. And that was both the rising threats of social democracy, socialism, communism, and on the other side of that, fascism, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in both of these projects, what they saw was you know, democratic social planning, state-managed economies had to be, by definition, socially engineered, which meant that they had to supplant, particularly in the social democratic case, free capital markets, and which means personal liberty in their formulation.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So
this was sort of an... This was like an emerge. Yeah.
No, you go. You have something. Please finish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm kind of rambling, but
no, not at all.
Sort of an emerging sort of theory of thought that was coming about, and what Bernays talks about in his theorizing of public relations, and why I kind of tie it to this larger ideological project, was that the idea was that not just that you could manipulate masses, right? That the masses left unchecked didn't know what they wanted and that they should be manipulated. So PR as a technology, as a neoliberal technology, isn't just about, you know, changing people's minds in some sort of magical Freudian psychoanalytic perspective, but actually, you know, teaching people what they want because you know better than they do.
And that's where it's really, because we'll get to Mount Pelerin in a few minutes, but they think this is really important that you brought in the Lippmann work, right? Because Walter Lippmann is, you know, Bernays, I think, because people do probably primarily know who he is through Chomsky or Adam Curtis. And even though we're such a PR saturated society, it's still kind like that actually is kind of a slur, like, oh, you're a spin doctor, or that's PR or whatever. But Lippmann was a public intellectual, and Lippmann was a serious guy, and he had much more noble ends. However, you know, as you point out, 1922, Public Opinion, which is his most famous work, was really a precursor to Bernays's own writings on public relations, and they're in it. You know, it's obviously Lippmann's concerns and orientations are different. They're less kind of commercial and crass, but they reflect that kind of elite preoccupation of, okay, there's going to be a democracy, I guess. Like, we don't want to have a fascist totalitarian society, but we also certainly don't want, like, you know, labor unions to run this country or people to, like, actually be democratized. They need to be guided. And maybe that is where the kind of guided terminology comes from. Is that right?
Yes, yes. So Lippmann is sort of credited with that exact term, guided democracy, which, you know, I point out is quite, and also it seems you were pointing out, is quite paradoxical, right?
Right.
And it's sort of, you know, he was, from my understanding, is that he was initially very critical of the role of propaganda and public relations. But also, like you say, you know, had concerns about, you know, the unwashed masses being responsible for themselves. Mm-hmm. And this is that sort of elite, this is where that kind of elite, managerial, technocratic view of liberal democracy comes from. That, again, there are, as you know, Lippmann says, you know, statesmanship consists in giving the people not what they want, but what they will learn to want. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very instructive to the ways in which these sort of elite technocrats, whilst believing that they're, I, you know, I don't think it's cynical. I think they really believed that they were committed to a better and just society, but that there is a resentment and a fear that is attached to the threat of social democracy.
And then that leads us maybe more like aggressively to the Mount Pelerin Society, right? So like if I'm understanding mm-hmm. the threads, we have Walter Lippmann, who is the public intellectual who's, you know, I think probably clearly in your mind and in my mind, super dangerous and wrongheaded, but sincere
yes.
and concerned and so on. And then Bernays is the like, hey, I can flip my uncle's stuff about, you know, neurotics in Vienna to sell some cigarettes and make a hell of a lot of money in the new world. Let's do this. And then we get to Mount Pelerin, which really, it's first of all, maybe explain Mount Pelerin a little bit because it's so crazy because I feel like if you're in political media, you actually in some ways spend a lot of time kind of being like, well, you know, of course there's power and of course power runs things, but like, you know, don't be Alex Jones about it. It isn't necessarily a smoke-filled room. Mount Pelerin kind of was like one of the closer mm-hmm. things in history of like, actually, yeah.
Yeah. This, like a smoke-filled Swiss Alps resort, you know?
Just, right. So what was it and what did they do and how does it fit into the story?
Yeah, so, well, Mount Pelerin, so that was in 1947, and that was a meeting that came about almost a decade after the initial meeting, which was the Colloque Walter Lippmann, that was actually the name of it, in Paris. Mm-hmm. So in 1938, just to continue the thread as you were laying out, so in 1938 you have the meeting in Paris, which inspired by Lippmann's inquiry into the principles of the good society, in which he makes a pretty strong critique of New Deal statism, right? Mm-hmm. And so you've got Lippmann there, and also the classical liberal and libertarian economists and philosophers of the time, so Michael Polanyi, Rothko, Rousseau, von Mises, but also very, very crucially, Friedrich von Hayek. Mm-hmm. And here, this is actually quite literally where the term neoliberalism is coined, not at Mount Pelerin, but in 1938 in Paris. And it's here where they start discussing how, you know, it's kind of funny when you think about it, but classical liberalism had kind of gone out of fashion during the interwar years because it was completely and wholly incapable of dealing with, you know, the economic collapse that had faced the country as well as the World War One, right?
Right.
And so they're trying to refashion a new sort of way of looking at it, or kind of a rebranding, if you want. And then, so here they coined this new term and this new project. And then about a decade later, some of those same people, as well as other bigger names that you might recall, such as Milton Friedman, mm-hmm. Meet now under the direction of Hayek in Mont Pelerin. And this is where, I think it's about 40 or so intellectuals. I mean, it's a huge, huge meeting. And here, this is where Hayek starts really to start formulating a lot of his ideas. And he, I think Corey Robin had a piece recently, I think it was in the Boston Review, that's quite good about Hayek's singular vision. And the neoliberals were very, they didn't like the idea of there being a single architect, funny enough. They liked the idea of their ideology being so diffused and so, there's no one single person to point to, that it sort of just had this sort of natural feeling to it as it spread everywhere. But Hayek really is, I mean, his vision is total, mm-hmm. I think, in a way that, only a handful of philosophers can maybe make claim to. But so, yeah, go
on. No, go ahead, go ahead.
No, but just that you're right that Mount Pelerin, is a really singular event, and that what it led to was basically, the idea that, like I said, there wasn't a single architect, but that there would be a generational commitment across the globe to, what would become, the sort of neoliberal attack, primarily in economics, but also within academics, political science, education, particularly in the American sense, also within social democracy in Western Europe.
And also how it would filter in this way that, like, sure, on one hand, neoliberalism's overused, and it's both because some people who are, they misuse it or they throw it around too much, and then other people like Jonathan Chait want to kind of, be dunces and pretend that it doesn't exist, right? And then there's but there is the way in which part of the reason it's used so much is because it is an all-consuming ideology. Like, it has been the hegemonic ideology of our time, and it does not only set macroeconomic policy, but even when, as an example, someone like a great theorist like Mark Fisher was self-critiquing the left, or, in terms of subcultures or political parties even, he could document and show the way that this ideology had seeped in and was creating practices and ideas, even in the areas where people thought they were resisting it. So it is really this all-consuming thing. And I think that we're going to get to the unguided plutocracy in a minute, but I want to put it in relation to Quinn Slobodian's book, where, mm-hmm. and I'm forgetting the name of it, unfortunately, but Matt was
Globalist.
Yeah, I think. Matt, yeah. So it's right? Yeah, totally. Thank you. So he basically documents that first that, yes, these people that you've been talking about did have a global project, and the problem with it in the popular discourse, though, is that it wasn't the effort. It wasn't like, oh, we're the guys who are responding to social democracy and Keynesianism and so on, or even communism, by saying, let the market be free. Let's deregulate. Let's be less bureaucratic. That even people who've critiqued them have ceded that ground to them. And actually, that's totally wrong. Their project was tremendously bureaucratic and tremendously governmental. It just was in a way that favored the interests, frankly, of the wealthy and landowners and corporate interests versus the sort of beginning steps of social democracy, of democratic mechanisms favoring workers, as an example. And I feel like what your piece is doing is not only showing that, but also showing the cultural dimension of it, which is getting this broad-based buy-in to an ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a right way to think of it?
I think Wendy Brown, the political theorist, mm-hmm. She's done some great work sort of explicating how, neoliberalism isn't just, an economic theory, like you say, or isn't just its domain. It's not just limited to those domains, but actually you know, it was sort of a larger rationality, right? Mm-hmm. When we say ideology or rationality, but that also demanded kind of a new conception of the self, right? And this is where it gets very dangerous. And you see it where she talks about, you know, that it economizes, neoliberalism economizes every aspect of our life. So you have, instead of thinking of the self as human, as a self, as a being, we start to conceive of ourselves as human capital. Things to be, and choices that we make in our life as ways in which to either, you know, appreciate or depreciate our social value.
Right.
And you see this as markets start popping up even in non-economic spheres within dating. This is a perfect example. Social media is a perfect example, you know, and all of these ways we start to, you know, this also has the intended and cascading effect of them further breaking down social bonds.
Right.
Because no longer are we people with social ties, but we are just bits of human capital in competition with other bits of human capital, right? And that also then further, like, entrenches the idea that all of these markets and the way that the sort of world is being governed is completely natural and rational. Because when you start to think of yourself as that way, then of course that is how the world is, right? And so it's quite dizzying, you know? And I think there's a good reason why, well, I think there's a lot of reasons why Jonathan Chait says that neoliberalism isn't a thing. I won't get into the non-generous reasons why I think he says that.
By the way, you can say that. If you want. You could take a few cracks. We're not above that here, but maybe you are, so no problem.
No. I mean, I think, why would you admit to being the thing that everyone hates? You know what I mean?
Right. But, word. Okay. I buy that. That's not even that ungenerous. That's just true.
No, yeah. It isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't. Yeah. No, but I do think that, you know, there's a reason why it's very difficult to kind of point to and figure out just how we got here and who is responsible,
right.
You know, and I don't think that that's unintentional. But I do think in America, it is unique. You know, I will say that I do think in Europe, you know, they at least have a bit more of a vocabulary and a history within their popular discourse and their popular punditry for what we call neoliberalism. And, you know, in America, we really don't. And I do think, you know, you bring up Jonathan Chait, although there's plenty more people to name. When you have a media class and a, you know, public intellectual class that not only, you know, was schooled in and went through the ranks of this very system, right? Because this revolution really starts to take place in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, at least within the global north. You know, either they still believe this is just the way things are, that nothing can, you know, this is the end of history. There is, you know, we have post-politics. This is just how everything is. Naturally,
right.
Or they have a vested interest in maintaining this, right? Because it maintains their position. So you've got kind of both things happening, as I think you mentioned, and as also, you know, that book Globalists really lays out clearly.
Totally. And then it's interesting because I do think of like a great essay, like Exiting the Vampire Castle, where it's sort of like, first these markets can get replicated in subcultures that actually undermine solidarity and broader efforts. And of course there's all sorts of complications there, but it is like a real factor that Fisher identified. And then also these mainstream, this is like the kind of like pseudo woke politics where it's like, okay, maybe we can absorb, you know, and it is particularly people, well, actually, Chade, to his credit, has not upgraded his racial understanding of this country at all. So in a way, he's maintained like a weird consistency, including in like not pretending to be woke. But, you know, like there are, you definitely, I mean, David Brooks, I mean, he wasn't known for like particularly inflammatory writing, but this guy literally came up through like the Weekly Standard ranks. This is not someone with any type of, you know, documented sophistication or nuance about race at all. Well, now all of a sudden he sports reparations. And on one hand, it's like, okay, that's a great cultural step that a conservative in the New York Times would grapple with that. But then it's also like, oh, you want to, there should be psychic restitution, not material ones. Okay, I see how this works. You can definitely still operate in your same logic, even as you upgrade the context around it. And that's how pernicious it is.
Yes, definitely.
What is unguided plutocracy in the last couple of minutes?
Good question. So what's been interesting is that now that we've kind of laid all of this out, you know, there, you know, our society does not look like anything that the neoliberals actually envisaged, right? Because they didn't want chaos, and they didn't want, they certainly didn't want Donald Trump to be president. You know, the vision for sort of lean, you know, lean states that secured private liberty, whilst maintaining, you know, calm global markets, you know, that doesn't, that is not what our actually existing society looks like, right? Quite the opposite, as we've got not just what's happening in America, but also, you know, the rise of the far right all throughout Western, Central, and Eastern Europe, as well as in Central America with Bolsonaro. And so, you know, after the 2008 crisis, and I do think, especially with the failures of the Obama administration to address that crisis in any meaningful way, this sort of technocratic elites have lost all legitimacy,
right?
And this is where we see this sort of chaos and this populist rage percolating and brewing throughout the world. But what's been interesting is that sort of on the flip side of that, flip side of the right, is that we have this sort of rise of the, or the return of this sort of liberal, not necessarily technocratic, but definitely bourgeois liberal, you know, clustered around sort of democratic urban party power. And they have run not into democracy, not trying to envisage a new society or a better society, but into the arms of the companies like Amazon and Google and Facebook.
Right.
And as these companies continue to put, and this is where I sort of tie it to Mr. Gawande, or Dr. Gawande, in that, you know, the corporations play into the hands of this. You know, if we've got Donald Trump in the White House, and, you know, dismantling the American regulatory system and finishing off in a lot of ways a lot of what the neoliberal project initially was in terms of complete and total privatization, then you've got, on the flip side, liberals running into new emerging governance structures from privatized companies.
That's that unbelievably stupid and horrible SNL sketch. And I say this like every other friggin', you know, of course I don't like SNL. I almost wish I could say I like SNL to play against type, to be honest with you. But there was that sketch that really did stand out with Steve Carell, where the whole premise is, you know, here's Jeff Bezos trolling Donald Trump, and we're laughing with Jeff Bezos at Donald Trump. And it's incredible, the shrinkage. Like, there's no, you know, again, I mean, don't write the sketches for the politics, but the ideology of that show, just distilling that, like, there isn't a movement in this country that's saying, you know, Amazon is a fundamental threat to supply chains, democracy. People are trying to kill themselves all over the country at these warehouses. And Donald Trump is a totalitarian racist fulfilling, you know, all of these. So maybe comedy or rebelliousness just in general maybe should object to both of those. But the whole sketch is just like, you know, Amazon is cool. I watch cool shows on Amazon Prime. Donald Trump's a jerk, but Jeff Bezos is going to win because he's smarter. I mean, that really is the distillation of the whole corruption and failure you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, so much of it comes down to Donald Trump is so personally disgusting.
Right.
Or, you know, it's just aesthetics
right.
that they find so disgusting because, you know, Donald Trump dismantling the state and allowing corporations to rise, these are not things in disagreement with each other, right?
Right.
Like, these are not two ideological forces battling it out. Like, it's quite the same project, actually. And so it's really dangerous, I think, and really needs to be pushed back on this idea that there are good corporate overlords or that these CEOs have anything to do with our best interests. It's horrifying, actually. And I think, you know, Amazon is a good example, but also Facebook.
Totally.
You know, it was recently, I don't know if you saw it recently, they just announced this, like, pivot to private. Have you seen this?
And the criminal probe that's opening against them around their data practices, yeah.
Well, it's interesting, this pivot to private, you know, a lot of people I saw, you know, really applauding it and, you know, oh, Zuckerberg is learning and he's responding not just to consumers, but citizens and their concerns about democracy and whatever, whatever, right?
How naive can people be? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's not just naive.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you really have to take a step back. You know, and look at what are these structures of production actually, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what you see is, you know, first of all, private does not mean privacy,
right?
So what does private mean? Okay, well, Facebook's entire structure is around extracting data, right, and hoarding data. So private interactions. If you're having more private interactions, then you're possibly having more meaningful interactions, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're having more meaningful interactions, then Facebook is able to extract more meaningful data.
Right.
And so this isn't a move or a pivot away from their initial, you know, business practice. It's really, you know, they're not, it's you know, an intensifying of their data extraction, and yet it's being billed or it's being sold to us as a civic good, as a virtuous move that they're doing, but it's not. And so this has the sort of, again, cascading effect of, you know, further disorienting us, not just as consumers, but as citizens, but then also regulators and politicians, right?
Right, right.
So it's quite dangerous. We have to really take a step back and try as much as we can to escape or at least push back on some of the ideological framework that we exist in somehow to take a more critical look at these systems of exploitation and production. So we can really understand what is, you know, at stake and what is going on here.
I don't want to be presumptuous, Liz, but we only have a minute left. It sounds like you're pretty stoked for Beto to run for president.
Oh, man, yeah. Love him.
I think he's hitting exactly the themes that you're writing and talking about here. The piece is excellent. It's Century of Spin, The Baffler. We have links to it. And actually, I hope we can definitely talk more. I think this stuff is incredibly important. And you do a great job laying it out. Liz Franzik, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, folks. Hope you enjoyed that interview. A great one. Check out Liz over at TruAnon, which has, you know, been, I think, like, well, I'll speak for myself, one of my favorite podcasts over the past couple of months, a year, I guess.
But them coming on the scene last summer was excellent. And I will say, I will too, this will be a rare moment where I toot my own horn. I believe us booking her for a Majority Report was the first time she had been on any of the these, you know, lefty podcasts, progressive podcasts.
She's very astute, too. I mean, she's a good find, because that last point about Facebook going private, I think you look at it in the context of it as the right-wing propaganda machine with, like, groups and how, like, the QAnon component of all this. I mean, very good, very wise to make us, I guess, suspicious of Zuckerberg at that moment, because I think she pretty much called it. Hey, Matt, how's it going?
Hey, guys. How you doing? Do you hear me?
Yep, hear you perfectly.
Perfect. Adam Clare. Perfect. You know, I'm here on the show and I'm ready to defend Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah,
let's do this.
Pelosi defender has logged on.
That's right. Oh, perfect. That was perfect timing there, Jamie.
Thank you.
The Pelosi defender has logged on. That is actually what I originally titled that video when I clipped it. I'm not sure what the title got changed to, but yeah,
It's something like Matt Binder defends Nancy Pelosi's honor from the Majority Report crew or something like that.
Yeah, I'm never going to leave that one down.
I hope that didn't mess up your weekend too much.
No, it was great. I got a bunch of people sending me gifts from medieval shows of someone like riding a knight's riding horses going, there's Matt going to defend his queen, Nancy Pelosi. Yeah, I'll take it.
That's right.
Actually, the most disturbing image was Lizard Rumsfeld over on Twitter photoshopped my face on top of Marcos from Daily Kos's face when he's meeting with Nancy Pelosi to hand her the 7,000 roses. That was easily the most disturbing. Everything else funny, that one made me question whether I want to go full throttle with this.
Lizard Rumsfeld's the best. I need to find that, actually.
Yeah.
Solid memes.
Oh, I found it. Here it is. One moment.
Are you going to put it up on?
Yeah, here it is.
Unbelievable. It? Unbelievable. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He found a really bad picture of me, too. It's amazing.
Wow. There he is, simping for the queen.
Before we go.
You know that's not me, because if it was me, there'd be way more roses. I would have sent way more. Mm-hmm. Wasn't enough.
Man, Marcos really did that. Well, okay. Well,
the funny thing is that the 7,000 roses in that photo are only the ones he personally delivered. There was something like 10,000 more that came.
Nice.
To do that and then to have her just completely like sit on her hands the entire time they have the house back is just
right.
Yeah. Delicious. Uh-huh. Maybe we'll get those tax returns one of these days, folks.
Maybe. November 4th.
Yeah. Daffodils. That's what Pelosi. Maybe if we got, it was the wrong choice, Marcos. You effed it up.
Right.
Before we go to the fun half, do one of you guys want to set up this sheriff's department story? There's a sheriff that's mad online.
Yes.
Yeah. Jamie was very excited about this one. You should take this.
Oh, he is so mad. Okay. So a little background first. The Huffington Post's Christopher Mathias recently published a story about an arrest carried out by some uniformed thugs in Spokane, Washington. You know, as we have been hearing out of the Pacific Northwest and elsewhere, they did not have on any clear markings. They refused to identify who they worked for when they were carrying out this arrest. And it seemed rather politically motivated because the guy who got arrested was Jeremy Logan, co-chair of the Spokane DSA, who was on his way to a protest. And they picked him up on a many years old warrant from a different county. Now, this is not new, I should say. Some people quite near and dear to me had their house raided on around the time of Occupy Wall Street on May Day and got hassled for and arrested on old open container warrants. They rifled through their stuff, tried to find out what activism they were associated with, et cetera, et cetera. Nevertheless, concerning that this is going on, right? So,
right.
So to compound this, this butthurt, right? So, I should say there's can we put up the quotes from the story, because when asked for comment, when reached for comment, or no, they did not actually give this comment to Huffington Post, but the cops are quoted in the story expressing their chagrin that somebody would be reporting on these kinds of activities. And they said, quote, yes, in a separate statement, the sheriff, Ozzy Knezovich, lashed out at the Huffington Post for writing the story, saying, quote, "I know it is difficult for the Huffington Post to understand the rule of law. They seem to have forgotten we are a country of laws. They've also forgotten their duty to our country to provide unbiased, factual reporting per the protections provided by the Constitution of the United States." Boo effing who. Are you guys enjoying these fascist tears yet? Well, the story gets even better, okay? So a guy named Chris Caesar, who is a bit of a prankster. We used to work together at Death and Taxes, actually, which was a very silly website blog once upon a time, wrote an email to the sheriff of Spokane saying, "Sir, I have some important intelligence to share about Antifa that I wanted to share with law enforcement. They fucking rock. Thank you, sir." Chris Caesar. So, you know, just like a pretty innocent prank. And then there's more. Another email asking him, "Are you free for a call?" So I guess
it's from the sheriff.
So I guess they didn't really get the part where he said they effing rock. I don't know. Or maybe they just wanted to get him on the phone so they could trace him. And Chris said, "LOL, no, I have a real job, unfortunately." He also appended a SpongeBob meme. Oh, yeah. Well, okay. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, don't get to the SpongeBob yet.
Sheriff said, "Well, you proved one point. True journalism is truly done." And then he said, "Oh, and thanks for the great optic / talking for my podcast / radio show and press conference. Okay,
I gotta say, I sort of respect the sheriff now, because as all good podcasters do, always mining the real world for content. So this sheriff has a podcast, apparently.
Yeah, I was gonna say, when I first looked at these, I thought it was Chris that saying it was for his podcast, but
no, nope.
Because I thought he's the one who has a podcast. Let's cite Chris's podcast. This awful pod. But yeah, so this, apparently the sheriff is a in the podcast business is a competitor. So,
well,
a
pod.
I mean, you gotta fight podcasts with podcasts. And as we all know, it is top podcasts are a major recruitment and radicalization tool of Antifa. So I guess makes sense.
This sheriff, apparently, when that Huffington Post piece came out, he held like a 45-minute press conference or something like that. I mean, this is clearly someone who likes to hear them.
He's like a media guy.
So the pièce de résistance in this is the SpongeBob meme that Chris Caesar has attached to his email, because, you know, the sheriff said he was going to have a press conference, and Chris Caesar said, "Well, here's a live picture of that press conference." And it is a meme where the character SpongeBob is depicted with the words, "Well, you proved one point. True journalism is truly done," in the, you know, the letters that change capitalization.
Uppercase, lowercase, yeah.
Which is designed to depict idiocy.
Can anyone throw in a SpongeBob chuckle so we could put a period on this one?
Well, actually, no. There's some.
There's so much more. So now... Now he's mad, right? He's mad. He's owned. He's not owned. He's laughing, okay? And he has a 45-minute-long press conference about this article, wherein he uses, as examples of media bias, these prank emails he received from Chris Caesar, including the SpongeBob meme. So what does that say about our law enforcement, that they can be driven practically to tears by a few innocent emails and a meme of a cartoon character from a show made for children and adult stoners?
All right. Also, this guy doesn't look like your typical podcaster.
This is another from an individual. And Daniel, I'm going to give you the entire slide deck so you don't have to worry about it. This individual, Chris Caesar, says that he's worked in for the Washington Post, Boston Globe, a few others.
He says his work has appeared in those places. Different distinction, but
sent me this saying, "Hey, have some intelligence to share about Antifa. They effing rock." He tell me that the media isn't biased towards Antifa or in favor of. These are journalists, folks. So I said, "Hey, you free for a call?" And he laughs and says, "No, I have a real job. Not the first time I've heard that." Slam. Job becomes really real when you have a baby die in your arms.
Oh, God.
Yes, people don't remember or realize what your law enforcement does for you.
Oh, my God. They kill babies, yes.
Nice optic. They sent me that. These are journalists. National. Washington Post type.
Yeah.
Washington Post type. Wonder what that type is.
I mean, yeah. We should just say Chris Caesar is a podcaster. The This Awful Podcast.
Not a Washington Post journalist.
I can't wait for law enforcement to start going after podcasters directly as enemy number one of the people.
Well, it's funny that they think before going to just rounding us up, they're going to try to compete with us on the battlefield of ideas by launching their own podcast.
Yeah, bring it on, bitches.
Yeah.
We're ready.
Oh, my gosh. I guess we need to listen to the sheriff's podcast.
I think we do. Yeah.
I've given myself some homework, but
if it's as hilarious as that little bit he just did, I am signing up on Patreon.
Wonder if they do cold opens.
Oh my God, I would love to see that.
You think they work on the bits? I mean, you think they're talking about it? And then you'll come in with a real funny impression, and. Oh boy.
So
all
good.
Right, folks. Well, we should probably plug some stuff. I'll begin. On TMBS this week, we had Milton Alamadi join us, talk about the pointless coup in Mali, what makes a pointless coup. We also talked about in Uganda, Yoweri Museveni is challenging his political opponent, who is a musician in Uganda, Bobby Wine. He's running a birther sort of play on him, saying he's actually 40 when he's saying he's 38. So see how that goes. But Milton talked to us about that. And then on Literary Hangover, I'm playing Flight Simulator 2020, flew around Bismarck. Mandan did a little hometown tour for folks. So yeah, twitch.tv/literary hangover there. Matt.
All right. I guess I'll go. Right. So, yeah, tonight on the show, youtube.com/Matt Binder at 9:30 and also later after the program on doomedpod.com as an audio podcast, I will be talking to Jess Skorain, who is the last progressive challenger in the last progressive primaries of 2020. Yes, that's right. This year is thankfully, slowly coming to an end. And even though we're in September, Delaware hasn't had their primary yet. So that's Tuesday. But tonight I'm talking to Jess Skorain, who's running for U.S. Senate. Interestingly enough, she's running against Chris Coons in what is Joe Biden's old Senate seat. So that would be a little cherry on top of the whole situation. You know, maybe something like progressive get the last laugh if she wins this one. Also, a new edition of my newsletter, misinfo.com, like misinformation, short for misinformation, went out this morning, where I look into the conspiracy theories that have been going around for the past day or two, where people on the right believe that the wildfires that have been really decimating the entire West Coast have been obviously started by, you guessed it, Antifa. yes, it's as ridiculous as it sounds. So misinfo.com for the newsletter, youtube.com/MattBinder, and doomedpod.com for the show tonight and the podcast.
All right. I will go now. So this week on the Antifada, Andy and Sean spoke with the great Brace Belden of the True Anon podcast about a little bit of labor history. They talk about how communist organizers like Harry Bridges, leader of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, exercised worker power in the past, and how we can fight to bring it back today. And they end with a call to build the party, which is something that's been on a lot of people's minds. What's a party? What should it do? How do we make it happen? They talk a lot about that. And later in the week, we're going to release a bonus wherein Brace and the guys talk all about punk rock because they are all aging punk rockers. Also, last Friday, I have not plugged this yet on this show, Andy's side project, Talkin' Tina, which is his project on Latin American politics, came out. And in this one, he discusses the coup in Bolivia through the lens of Marx's 18th Brumaire with Jose Lastra Soria. So that is, I haven't listened to it yet, but it sounds super interesting. Everyone should check that out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Also, today, right after Majority Report is over, I'm going on the Nomi Key Show to talk about socialist feminism. So I hope everybody tunes in for that.
A little bit disappointed I wasn't invited to be on the aging punk rocker show.
Well, we'll have to do another one for you because I wasn't invited either.
Oh, so I guess we'll just do our own then, Jamie.
Yeah, we'll do our own side project about what it means aging to be an aging punk rocker. Yeah,
I mean, that definitely is a thing. There's certainly a big enough audience out there of like old punk rockers and punk rock parents, and that's something that we should do. Mm-hmm.
Hell yeah. I'll have my people talk to your people.
Oh, let's do it. But first, it's time for the fun half. Let's go.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of banks. A hell of a lot of banks. A hell of a lot of banks. Hell of a lot of banks.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Cannot hustle.
Come on.
Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on.
Well,
come on.
What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.